Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are your memories of the assassination of President Kennedy? Thousands of North Texans who were along the motorcade route in 1963 have firsthand recollections of the shooting and its shocking aftermath. For countless others, images of the weekend are deeply informed by the media coverage that surrounded it. Some of that footage, including rarely broadcast home movies and scenes from inside Dallas Police Headquarters, is featured in a new documentary that will be screened tomorrow at the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza before making its television debut on the National Geographic Channel Monday, November 23rd at 8. The film is called The Lost JFK Tapes, The Assassination. Executive producer Tom Jennings is here to talk about it, along with Gary Mack, who is director of the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. Welcome, both of you, to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Tom, how much of this footage had you seen before you started to work on the film?
Well, I first met Gary 14 years ago when I was doing a different documentary about the events of that weekend. And Gary at the time had just acquired some of the local footage from Channel 4 here and was telling me about it. And the more he told me about it, the more I realized there was something extraordinarily special about it. And we gave a look at it, and a lot of what I saw at the time were shots from inside the Dallas police station when Oswald is being led up and down the hallway, and there's this throng of reporters and police officers around him. And it was the kind of thing that I'd never seen before, and I'm a fan of the story. You know, it's a big part of history and in growing up in the United States. And I just, as much as I thought I'd seen everything, I realized I had not seen any of this. So Gary and I kept in contact over the years, and I kept telling him, I want to do a documentary, but I want to do it different. I want to do it in a way that people have never seen it before, where you almost immerse yourself in the footage, and it's as if you're there during that time period. And what we've done over the years in keeping in touch with Gary in the Sixth Floor Museum is unearthed as much of the never-before-seen footage and audio recordings that people are not familiar with. And we purposely left out some of the iconic things that people know.
Cronkite,
the Zapruder film. We did that on purpose because we wanted people to know that there was a much more genuine approach to seeing what happened in Dallas at that time.
Gary, by the way, I think I messed up your title on introduction. You're curator
of
the Sixth Floor Museum.
Right, yeah.
Forgive me. That was my error.
Well, if I've had a promotion, that's great.
Not sure your bosses would.
Okay.
Can you talk about how the TV and the radio stations that had this news footage, did they really understand the value of what they had?
Well, you know, the bottom line really for the individual stations is that this is a very competitive news market, and each of the stations was very protective of their footage. And, you know, they're well aware that some of the things that they have might not exist at one of the other stations. So they weren't apt to share with the other stations. You won't find Channel 4's footage on Channel 8 and vice versa, unless, you know, there's some major event going on. What I understood, having worked in radio and TV in the Dallas-Fort Worth area for quite a while, was that the long term is that this material needs to be preserved, and it needs to be available to more than just the viewers and listeners in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I knocked on the door at Channel 4 first, and I don't know, maybe the planets were lined up properly or something. I said, look, would you consider donating all of your Kennedy assassination coverage to the Sixth Floor Museum? And they thought about it and said, well, okay. And they did. So from there, I was able to knock on other doors. So, pardon me. As of right now, we own all of the footage from Channel 4, Channel 8, and Channel 11. We are storing most of the footage from Channel 5, and we have ongoing discussions with them. And I'm sure that eventually their material will come to us. Along with the Channel 4 footage came the KRLD radio tapes. Back in the 60s and 70s, it was KRLD TV, AM, FM. And in the 70s, the stations were split off. Well, the TV station, which is now Fox 4, kept the KRLD radio tapes. And even the KRLD people didn't even know where their tapes had gone. So now we have those, and Tom used those in his program. And when we got the donation from Channel 8, that included the WFAA radio tapes. They had a radio station at 570, and those tapes were included. And I don't think anyone knew where those tapes had gone.
And a lot of this stuff had to be converted so that you could use it on modern equipment.
Yeah, the original videotapes are 2 inches wide, and this is really an obsolete format. It's so obsolete that there aren't enough tape machines, operating tape machines, that can dub everything before the parts wear out. That's how bad it's gotten. So we've remastered all of that material, and I think you know firsthand that that work was done for KERA when KERA and the 6-4 Museum co-produced JFK Breaking the News in 2003. And so now we have digital preservation copies of all of that footage, and that's that made Tom even more excited.
It did. Just to add to that, when Gary and I first talked, when I did a program many years ago, he had acquired this 2-inch black and white videotape, and some of it was falling apart. In order to transfer it, we basically had one shot to run it through the machine to capture what was there. The good news is it did run through the machine, even though some of it did fall apart after the fact. And even better news, because it was 2 inches at the time, the amount of information that's stored on each frame of that videotape is very dense, which means when we see it today, even when it's on a big screen, like people can see it tomorrow at the museum, the image quality holds. And so you're sitting there looking at something that is remarkable in that it looks, much of it looks as if it could have been filmed yesterday, except it's in black and white.
You know, it bears reminding people here how far technology has come. Just getting a remote live shot up in 1963 was a minor miracle.
Well, we had an image with some of the we had an issue with some of the images that we were using, in that there were remote live shots that went up. And you can tell the difference between that and what they stored on either video or film, because there's this, if you can picture in your mind's eye, there's kind of this wave in the footage. And the footage seems to be undulating, and you can't quite figure out why. And one of the technical people that worked on the show said, oh, that's from the microwave transmission at the time. So I got a little lesson in technology.
Yeah, in addition to interesting images, the technical imperfections were recorded and preserved also. But, you know, that's part of the way people saw the Kennedy assassination coverage back then.
Let's listen to a clip now of some of that live coverage. I'm not sure if the audio portion here is from a radio report. I'm sure you can both tell me as soon as we hear it, or television. But let's take a listen.
That, by the way, the plane you're seeing now is a C-123, which transported in the famous bubble top limousine, which the President and the First Lady will ride in. However, that limousine now is down in front of the welcoming ramp. Yes, I can see it from here, and it does not have the top up. So our information from some of the Secret Service men earlier was correct, that depending on the weather, nice weather, no rain, top will be down. For all of you people who will see the parade downtown, you'll see a glimpse of the President and First Lady in the flesh rather than through the bubble top glass on the outside.
Yeah, that's Bob Walker. He was the news director at Channel 8 back then, and Bob went on to a long, distinguished career with ABC Radio. He just passed away a few weeks ago. So, and I never knew where the man was. We wanted to do an oral history with him, and I could never find anyone who even knew where he was. Turns out he'd been in ABC Radio in New York for decades.
And it's such a, you know, the way they reported then, I really loved listening to the words they use, how they sound, the kind of passion in their voice. It seems like, you know, some of that was lost in the years since the Kennedy assassination. And they paint such vivid pictures with their words that it helped us in trying to put this film together, because the narrative was as good as any narration that a writer could write today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder if some of that comes from the fact that they did have backgrounds either in print or in audio only, and so they were accustomed to really describing things as opposed to saying the video is first and foremost.
Yeah, that's certainly a good observation. The radio people especially, you know, you have to paint word pictures. You have to help people understand what you are seeing, and you have to do it in a way that is an interesting, compelling fashion. And so a lot of these guys that you see and hear in the TV coverage came from radio, and they knew how to make these images come alive for people who could only listen because they're listening on the radio.
And as a matter of fact, a couple of the images that we do use, sequences, some of the guys are sitting in front of a television camera at a table doing a report to TV while they're talking on a microphone on a telephone, doing the radio report at the same time. So they're broadcasting in both mediums at the same time.
To give you an idea how primitive things were in television in those days, Channel 5, which was pretty much the market leader in news ratings in those days, they had a Fort Worth office and a Dallas office. They had two film cameras that could do sound. All the other photographers were using cameras that could not record sound at all. And they felt that was plenty. Now, today, you don't cover any news story with a camera that doesn't pick up sound, but that's the way it was then. So when someone needed to do a filmed interview with someone, if that person was in Dallas, they would send someone out from the Dallas office. Well, if you had two people that you needed to interview, you were stuck until the guy from Fort Worth could get over to Dallas with his camera. I mean, really primitive conditions for covering a breaking news story.
And this was sort of an all-hands-on-deck situation, so that when they went back to the studio, there were people essentially on the news desk who were not typically reporting the news.
Exactly. When Jack Ruby shot Lee Harvey Oswald, his sister, Eva Grant, came down to the police station, and she was accompanied by Channel 4's weather guy. And she didn't know him, and he didn't know her, but because he had been in her living room every night telling her what the weather would be, she felt comfortable with him. And that's the only one she would talk to for a while.
It really was, I think, the first 24/7 news story for television. It was the first time they just turned the cameras on and let them run because they didn't know what to do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking about the new film, The Lost JFK Tapes, The Assassination. It will screen tomorrow at the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. It premieres on the National Geographic Channel Monday, November 23rd. There are, Gary, still some false live reports circulating around out there, things that sound as if they were made at the moment that the president was shot. Can you tell us the status of those?
Yeah, and we run into that a lot. And one of them that is continuing is the early report said that a Secret Service man had been killed. And that just bounced around the news wires all afternoon. No Secret Service men were injured, much less killed. And so now we're stuck with, how did these news reports originate? And no one's been able to track back to figure out which reporter filed that report. So you have to wonder, okay, well, what happened? Well, we do know that a Secret Service man in the car right behind Kennedy jumped off the car, ran up and jumped onto the trunk to help Jackie. Someone may have misunderstood what he was seeing, because at one point this agent kind of fell down on the trunk, and someone may have thought that, well, he had been shot, but he wasn't. He just kind of lost his grip. But you know, that's all we can know. So even though all this marvelous footage still exists, it doesn't necessarily answer every question.
I actually like those moments, Tom, in the film where we hear things that we know today are not true, because it reminds us all that this is the first draft of history and not history itself.
Exactly. There's several in there that I love and we discovered as we went through. And I think one of my favorites is when one of the initial reports of trying to figure out who the assassin of President Kennedy was there was a report that said, now we're now hearing that the assassin was actually a man and a woman. And you just realize that the misinformation that was flying around so rapidly at the time, they were just desperate to try and figure something out. And we get to hear that.
And from there, 1,000 conspiracy theories were born.
At least.
Gary Mack and Tom Jennings are here. We're talking about The Lost JFK Tapes, The Assassination. You can join us right now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
What was a wonderful welcome in downtown Dallas, has become a scene of indescribable horror as hundreds of people crowd outside the back door to the emergency room here at Parkland Hospital. Faces are ashen white, and people are wondering, is our president going to live? And two priests have just been sent in to the room with the president.
When I walked into the emergency room and saw there, lying on the portable table, the President of the United States, he was covered with a sheet, but I removed it, I'd say, halfway down his face in order that I might administer the rites of the church to him. His eyes were closed. Mrs. Kennedy was there during the time that I administered the sacraments to the President, and after that, she left the room, as I also did. And I spoke to her in the corridor, the adjoining corridor. I expressed my sympathy to her and the sympathy of my parishioners. And she thanked me for doing so and asked me to pray for her departed husband. I assured her that I would.
That is a clip from the new documentary, The Lost JFK Tapes, The Assassination. First, you heard reporter Bob Huffaker, followed by Father Oscar Huber. My guests this hour are the producer of that film, Tom Jennings, who has produced it for the National Geographic Channel, where it will debut Monday, November 23rd. It also will premiere at the 6th Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza, so curator Gary Mack is with us as well. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Tom, I think it's in that scene where we actually see a photograph of the president after he has died. It's not particularly graphic, but I wonder if there were a lot of sort of weighty discussions over including that in the broadcast.
Yes, there were a lot of discussions about it. How to use it, if we did use it, did we use it properly? The National Geographic Channel studied it closely. We wound up using it in a way, when you see the film, that you can tell that it's the president and that he's died, but that the image is actually much smaller than any of the other images used in the film. And we purposely actually kind of drifted away so it floats off into darkness. We thought it was important to show. We've got permission from all types of people who are involved in releasing that photo, and we were sure to use it in a way that we thought was had a certain reverence to it and still was able to tell the story.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes, hi. I was curious, on the 40th anniversary of the assassination of JFK, Robert Oswald gave an interview in which he basically said Oswald did not get enough attention from his parents, and therefore he went out and shot the president. And I went down that day. This fascinated me. And I went down the day of the 40th anniversary, and I saw press milling around, and Jesse the Body Ventura showed up, and then the crazies came. And my question is simple. Why has Dallas given this sorrowful event over to people who basically, just like Oswald, attach their identities to this terrible event? Why can't there be some way of honoring this sorrowful event without giving it over to people who, in an unhealthy way, can't control themselves? I don't mean to be critical of anybody, but I didn't find too much valuable to cover there that day. The press on the 40th anniversary sort of milled around waiting for something to happen. And, of course, it did happen because, for the first time in a while, people were paying attention. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call. What do you think about that, Gary?
Well, that's an excellent question and observation. The reality is the public opinion surveys have shown that most people just simply do not believe the lone gunman story of the Warren Commission at all. And they don't really know what did happen. And there are a lot of people who study it all the time. As my part of my responsibility as curator at the museum is to be able to keep on top of all this stuff and what's going on and how might that change our exhibits or publications. The reality is the Kennedy family is not happy that President Kennedy is remembered on the day he died. They have much preferred that he be remembered on his birth date, And the city of Dallas used to have a small service at in Dealey Plaza up until the early 80s when the Kennedy family issued literally a statement saying, we prefer people remember the president on his birthday. So from that moment on, the city has stopped observing the anniversary. And now the only official observance, there are no official observances. The museum, we usually put up some flowers in our entryway into the exhibit, but that's all, for the very simple reason the Kennedy family prefers it that way. And I think we don't really see any reason to counter that. But those who feel that a great crime was committed and you know the country was taken away and all these other theories that they come up with, they are quite committed to gathering and promoting their beliefs that there was more to it than just Oswald.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Craig in Dallas. Hi, Craig.
Hi. I thought I was in Houston 3 or 4 weeks ago and saw this. I don't know if it was a preview on the National Geographic station, but what I thought was so striking was the amount of smoking that all the broadcasters did, even while they were interviewing people on the tapes.
There's the stamping out of a live cigarette right on the air as well.
We were amazed that as we went through the footage, and we have a show that's 90 minutes long that's going to be on National Geographic Channel. There are hours and hours and hours of reporters smoking cigarettes on air, not just looking for the story where they're caught on camera somewhere, but literally on air, sitting at desks, interviewing witnesses to what happened at Dealey Plaza. It goes on continuously, actually.
Yeah. So, and smoking wasn't unusual in those days. I mean, it's a great taboo today. So we have this marvelous ability now to go back in time, 46, almost 47 years now, and see how things were. And some of them were very different than today.
Exactly. And I think that is part of the beauty of putting the film together the way that we have. It shows kind of what life was really like, how we functioned as a society then, and what was acceptable.
Another thing that's really interesting is when, and as you mentioned, Tom, you did not use the Zapruder film, but you do have a wonderful little interview that was done with Abraham Zapruder, one of the only ones, soon after he had captured this footage. And let's listen to that now.
May I have your name, please, sir?
My name is Abraham Zapruder.
Mr. Zapruder?
Zapruder, yes, sir.
Zapruder, and would you tell us your story, please, sir?
I got out and about a half hour earlier and get into a good spot to shoot some pictures. And I found a spot, one of these concrete blocks that I have down near that park near the underpass. And I got on top there. There was another girl from my office. She was right behind me. And as I was shooting, as the president was coming down from Houston Street making his turn, it was about halfway down there, I had a shot. And he slumped to the side like this. Then I had another shot or two. I couldn't say what it was, one or two. And I saw his head practically open up, all blood and everything. And I kept on shooting. That's about all. I'm just sick again.
I think that pretty well expresses the entire feelings of the whole world.
Terrible.
You have the film in your camera.
I brought it on the studio.
We'll try to get that processed and have it as soon as possible. Right now, we have videotape.
Of course, we know today it wasn't processed as soon as possible, or certainly wasn't made available as soon as possible for public viewing.
Yeah, I mean, that interview was done live on Channel 8 and carried on the ABC network literally 2 hours after the assassination. And when Channel 8 donated everything to us, they also gave us a series of still photographs, and one of them is in there, and it shows Zapruder's business partner, Irwin Schwartz, standing behind the cameras. He's holding Zapruder's camera in the bag, and the film is still in it. Right after that interview ended, Channel 8's chief photographer and assistant news director, Bert Shipp, called Kodak, because he knew those people, and said, look, there's a guy here with a film. You need to process this right away. Can you get on this? And they said, sure, bring him over. So a Dallas police officer drove Zapruder and Schwartz over to the Kodak lab out near White Rock Lake, and it was processed that afternoon.
And how long was it before America saw that film?
12 years. And Life magazine bought the film the next morning and sat on it. They allowed frames from the film to be published not only in their publications but in other publications around the world. But they did not let the film be seen publicly. They just thought it was too gruesome and it would be too exploitative to show the film. But then in 1975, as people were starting to question the Vietnam War and the Watergate break-in, there was a bootleg copy floating around, and Geraldo Rivera got his hands on one, and he had an evening show on ABC. His announcer was Don Imus. There's a trivia bit for you. And Geraldo showed it, and it created an absolute sensation because as people who've seen it, and you see the president seemingly knocked backward, supposedly by a shot fired from behind. Well, that doesn't make sense to a lot of people. There is a good explanation for it, but that's not the point. It's the first time the public had seen the film, and the controversy led to the creation of a new investigation into the assassination.
And we chose not to use it for...
Yeah, talk about that again.
Well, for a number of reasons. One was because the film wasn't seen publicly for so many years after. And we wanted to be true to the days that we were chronicling.
This is the real-time presentation.
The real-time presentation. Mm-hmm. And another thing was because we came across this interview with Abraham Zapruder, with Jay Watson, I believe, mm-hmm. who was the news director. At
Channel 8's program director.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And
did a remarkable job that weekend, by
yes,
the way.
Yes, he did.
He did. He was something to watch. And we felt that if we had run the Zapruder film in the sequence when we were detailing what happened at Dealey Plaza when the shots were fired, it would be, in a sense, manipulating the timeline. The footage wasn't developed at that point. It wasn't seen for so many years later. So we wanted to be true to what we had. Plus, we had this remarkable interview with Zapruder, and we felt like, well, how could we show his film earlier and then show his interview and talk about how they're all waiting to develop the film, and we'll see if you captured any of this on your camera.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The new film we're talking about is called The Lost JFK Tapes, The Assassination. There will be a screening tomorrow at the 6th Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. Find out about that on the Think page of KERA.org. The film premieres on National Geographic Channel Monday, November 23rd at 8 o'clock our time. Let's go next to Andy in Arlington. Hello, Andy.
Hi. I don't know if I'm a victim of Wikipedia or not, but I had heard that Ted Cassidy, the actor who played Lurch, was a field reporter on the scene that day for WFAA, and I was wondering, I've never heard anybody verify that. I was wondering if your guests knew anything about that.
Thanks for coming.
I can verify it. Ted Cassidy was working for WFAA radio at that time, and I don't think he was in Dealey Plaza. I'm not sure that he was a newsman. I think he was just a radio personality then. I don't mean it just a radio person, you know. But he conducted one of the very first interviews. Tom's film includes the Channel 8 interview with William and Gail Newman, who were the bystanders who were the closest to President Kennedy when that fatal shot was fired. And either just before the TV interview or immediately after, Ted Cassidy interviewed the Newmans. And unfortunately, WFAA radio was not recording their broadcasts at that point. So that interview is lost. But Ted Cassidy, Lurch from the TV show, was actually the one. So I can certainly confirm that. You bet.
And we do see them in the film because they were interviewed in studio a few minutes later.
That's correct. And the way I understand it is that when the event occurred, the reporters were just hauling anyone they could out of Dealey Plaza over to the broadcast stations that were fairly nearby. And they were some of the first people interviewed. And when you look at the footage and the photographs, you see how so close they were to the Kennedys when the shots went off. And they are almost iconic in that if you can think of that photograph with the mother and the father laying on the ground protecting their two children. Mm-hmm. What adds to that iconic moment is the interview in studio shortly after the fact that most people haven't seen.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Don in Garland. Hello, Don.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, Chris.
Sure.
This question is for Mr. Mack and Mr. Jennings. Since you all have access to a lot of Channel 8 WFAA's material, I was wondering if you might have an old historical interview, I say historical, 1999 in the summer of where Gloria Compost and John McKay aired a story concerning negatives that were found in the basement of WFAA's film vault that showed apparently a Dallas police officer posing as the famous photograph of Lee Harvey Oswald holding the gun up, the negatives having shown the head had been cut out, sliced, and diced. The story went on where Channel 8 actually found the officer retired in Oklahoma and interviewed him, and he indicated that, yes, he'd been asked to stand and do those shots and then model those shots. This broadcast was done at 5 p.m. in the evening. When I got home from work, I saw the last part of it, so I thought I would be smart and put my VCR tape in and catch the same story at 10 o'clock. The story was pulled. I never saw it again, and no one else has seen it. So my question to you is, do you have access to that videotape?
Well, those tapes still exist. The Sixth Floor Museum does not have those. We have the historic footage from the 60s. That was a story, actually, that several Dallas-Fort Worth stations were on. And I think Channel 4 found the officer involved, Bobby Brown, I think, who lives up in Oklahoma. And I think Channel 4 did some follow-up stories. It's interesting in that people who've seen the famous photograph of Oswald in the backyard of his house holding his rifle and his pistol and some newspapers, he claimed once he was shown those pictures that they were fake. And at some point, the Dallas police decided, well, you know, is it possible someone could have faked these pictures? And they actually had one of their officers, Bobby Brown, try to recreate it. And Bobby came to the conclusion that, well, it's certainly possible, but these pictures are not fake. They are legit. And that was confirmed, of course, by Oswald's widow and by Oswald's mother, who had seen one of the same pictures, just in a different pose.
It is remarkable how rumors get started and take hold. And, you know, you hear part of something and not the rest of it, and mm-hmm. you don't have the full picture of things.
Yeah.
We are speaking this hour with Gary Mack, curator of the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza, and Tom Jennings, executive producer of the new film, The Lost JFK Tapes, The Assassination. That premieres on National Geographic Channel Monday, November 23rd at 8. If you'd like to join the conversation, send us an email. The address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
More caution and protection has been used for this man than anything had ever been seen in the city of Dallas. Probably more than had been used to protect the President of the United States. In fact, Dallas City Hall is normally a public building, but today it was really under armed guard.
Jack Ruby on the carousel. Remember the carousel shot.
Is this a confirmed report as to who did the shooting?
As far as I know, I just got it from Vic Robertson.
Vic Robertson from City Hall reports that Jack Ruby, the owner of the Carousel, which is a bar in Dallas, did the shooting.
That is another clip from the new film, The Lost JFK Tapes, The Assassination, premiering on the National Geographic Channel on Monday. Gary Mack, curator of the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza, is with us, along with Tom Jennings, executive producer of the film. For a little background on what we just heard, or a little explanation, part of the reason that you hear that odd tone in the voice of the broadcaster that we're hearing is that Jack Ruby was not a stranger to the media community in Dallas.
You know, well, every city has a guy like Jack Ruby, where, you know, when something's going on, guys like Jack Ruby show up and they hang out with reporters and cops and anyone else who's, you know, well, famous people, celebrities and all that. And it's hard to get a handle on how many people either knew Jack Ruby or Jack Ruby knew. He was a name dropper. So, you know, so he was just hanging out with these people and handing out free passes to a strip club and all. And it's quite possible that someone may have seen Ruby in the basement shortly before he shot Oswald and didn't think anything of it. I mean, he's one of us. I've seen him a million times. And then he shoots Oswald. I'm not going to tell anybody. you know, that could very well be the situation. Of course, then the other side, of course, is that the mob put him up to it. But then, you know, the people who knew Ruby say he's the last guy you would have trusted with anything. The guy couldn't keep a secret for 5 minutes.
And I think, too, the reaction of the news reporters is he was a fairly well-known character in town at the time. And so when that report comes into the news directors on the air, and he looks at it because I think the reaction, it must have been some shadowy figure that, you know, came from some other place that we don't know. And all of a sudden, it's the guy that owns the Carousel Theater. I know that guy, you know, and you can almost hear the shock in his voice. Wait a minute, I know the guy who shot Oswald.
Yeah, yeah. They were. I had the impression that it was Bob Walker, Channel 8's news director, and I have the impression that he was concerned that from a legal standpoint, if you say that Jack Ruby shot Oswald, well, you have to say allegedly or is believed to have. And so he was concerned that that name would get out. And interesting the way you played it on the just moments ago and the way it appears in Tom's show, they've cranked up the volume so you can hear it. But people actually watching Channel 8 at the time could not have heard that name.
The whispering of Jack Ruby.
Yeah. So anyway, that's how the name came out, at least on Channel 8. On NBC, Tom Pettit was their reporter, and he closed his live broadcast by saying, "Oh, we understand a man named Jack Loeby has shot him." So he didn't even get the name right.
Tom, I know that there are, you know, to get these little brilliant nuggets, there are literally hundreds of hours of videotape, let alone the audio tape from that weekend, from all these different sources, because they were pretty much going 24/7, or to the extent that they could back in those days. How much time did you spend watching and listening to all of these sources?
Well, we all kind of took turns, but there were actually only four of us who worked on this film, which is kind of remarkable when you think about it, and including Gary as well, who kind of was a wonderful guide to help us find certain things. But what we did was we got screeners from the Sixth Floor Museum, and we had a footage researcher, a guy named Woody Farmer, who sat down, and his job was to go through every logs that may have existed already and then create new logs that, with a specific eye toward what we were looking for, which was material that had never been seen or rarely seen. And then the associate producer, Liza Douglas, and Ron Frank, the producer-editor, then took that kind of smaller mountain and started to throw things out. And then they would create sequences, and we would sit down and we'd watch the sequences. And it took months and months and months of sorting to try and find the best stuff. And we threw out hours and hours of material that could be played over, you know, that could we could create entirely new shows based on what's there. There's so much material. We tried to stay true to a timeline, and we did that. But, you know, we had to really say goodbye to some special things that I wish could have stayed in there. The hardest part was to get the pacing right, because in a sense, when you watch it, and I think this is what we're all most proud of, is that we took an archive from 45 years ago, and we've cut it in a way that is visually pleasing to a modern audience. We tried to make it play almost like it, and it does play like a feature film. So we're using News Archive as a feature film in and of itself. There's no narration, there's no interviews, it just plays, and the people who have seen it, you know, when they sit down and they watch it, they're fortunately mesmerized by it, because you're seeing this material in a format that it's not normally used in.
The effect is such that it's like sitting in your easy chair back in 1963 and changing the channel at all the best moments so you don't miss anything. That's what it's like.
And Gary had reminded me that one of the things that we're most proud of in working with the Sixth Floor Museum is we were able to assemble this real-time film using all of these sources in a way that had not been combined before. So the different channels, people would sometimes just get WFAA footage. Well, we've gotten the three or four archives available here, along with things that have not been seen before that Gary guided us to at places like the JFK Museum. And we've assembled it using the best of the best. So that's what people see when they watch it.
You know, one thing, I've seen a fair amount of footage from this weekend, and one thing that I had never heard before was the audio of the conversation between then-President Johnson and Rose Kennedy.
And that goes on and on and on. We used a brief piece of it, but Yeah, Gary can tell you a little bit about that.
Yeah, the Air Force One cockpit recordings. The National Archives has that tape. It's an edited tape, and I know some researchers who've been trying to find the original unedited tapes and have failed so far, which is kind of interesting. But a lot of it was preserved, and, you know, there's this moment when Lyndon Johnson wanted to call Rose Kennedy and express his condolences. And what a difficult moment. And you get the impression listening to her that while she appreciated the call, he's not the most important person in her life right at that moment. You know, but he made the effort. You know, Johnson's always portrayed as this lout of a fellow and, you know, a very crude and, you know, poor manners and all that. Of course, the reality is very different. Lyndon Johnson was extremely conscious of the image of not only himself as president at that moment, but he had to convey to the rest of the world that this country, although it had been struck very hard, was far from being crippled, and that this country would continue as if nothing had happened. And that's he worked very hard at that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Sharon in Dallas. Hello, Sharon.
Yes. Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Welcome.
I'm very excited about, I'm really looking forward to this film. I have a question that I have had since 1977. I believe that there's a camera owned by Phil Willis in the Kennedy Museum, and his daughter was my college roommate. And I knew that he had been there taking pictures that day when Kennedy was assassinated. And eventually, in 77, I asked her what she knew about it, what she had learned, you know, from her dad about the assassination and stories and things. And her answer was that she couldn't discuss it because her family attorney had advised her and her family not to. And I just wondered if your research or your experiences, you had any idea why folks were advised not to talk to people like that.
Thanks for your call.
Well, was your friend...
we
lost
got her. No, we got her.
Okay, was that Linda or Rosemary Willis?
Sharon?
Rosemary.
Rosemary. I've not heard that story. I knew the Willis family for quite a few years, and all of his original slides were acquired by the museum, as was his camera. And, in fact, the skirt that Linda was wearing that day, a gold-colored skirt, you can see her in the Zapruder film. There was a time... The Willis family, like a lot of folks who were there and saw and heard it happen, they just did not want to talk about it. It was just too painful for them. And a lot of times they would come up with an excuse to not have to talk to people about it. So I don't know, but I would guess that that may have been the reason why Rosemary said what she did. I mean, I've never heard that from Phil or his wife or Linda or Rosemary, that they were advised to not talk.
You know, that's certainly a way in which our culture has really changed between then and now. And it also strikes me that if, God forbid, anything like this were ever to happen again, you would have not little snippets and not chance blurry photographs in the distance and not one Zapruder film.
Yeah.
But in fact, there would be 1,000 different sources. You'd have digital pictures and you'd have people taking video on their phones. It's really sort of an odd thing to think about.
Yeah, it really is. And... I'm not sure where I was going with that. There are still so many cameras out there. You can all these films and photographs the museum has acquired, and we're always looking for more. When you look in the background, you can see people with cameras, and you know that their pictures have not surfaced yet. And you know, we just hope that they wind up at the museum for preservation someday.
And I think, you know, we're so used to, like what you said, Chris, is that we're so used to. Coverage of an event today being so all-encompassing. You know, every angle is covered. You know, there's long shots, there's close shots, there's, you know, everything is covered. Back then, it wasn't covered quite as much. And I think that's why it's important for us to assemble footage like what Gary has at the museum in a way that allows people to connect with it, to connect with it in a way that they're used to seeing how events are covered today. And that's what we were trying to do, is to assemble it in a way with pacing and timing and music that a modern audience will visually understand.
On the other hand, the fact that there are sort of media professionals dealing now with reporters who would come to cover something means that if this were to happen today, we would have none of the footage of Oswald in the courthouse. We would have none of the footage of him being shot as he was transferred. There's a lot, in fact, that cameras are kept away from.
Yeah, that's true. The Dallas police were in a very awkward position in that there were rumors, not just in Dallas, but literally all over the world, that the Dallas police were beating Oswald. I mean, he had a cut on his eye and the other eye was blackened. That was from the fight when Oswald resisted arrest and tried to kill
in the theater.
When Oswald tried to kill a cop in the theater. But all these rumors were going around, and the rumors were becoming more important than anything else. So the Dallas police and some of the city leaders felt obligated to make him visible once police transferred him from their custody to the county in preparation for the trial. And that's why there was that transfer in front of live cameras and stuff, just to make him visible and available, because coverage at the county jail would not be nearly as easy and just wouldn't happen very much. And it just, you know, that's when Ruby got in and lost control of himself. His nickname was Sparky, because he had this very quick temper, you know, punch first, ask questions later. And Sparky killed him. It's what an amazing story. You can't make up a story better than that one.
And also, to me, in looking at the footage, it represents kind of the innocence of the time. People talk a lot about the lost innocence after the Kennedy assassination. And, you know, from the motorcade images on down to the shooting of Oswald in the basement of the jail, you see these things that we would just never see today. You would never see the President of the United States propped up in the back of a limousine, surrounded by throngs, thousands of people that could literally reach out and touch him as he's driving past. Mm-hmm. You just realize that this just wouldn't be done today. So it is also a glimpse into how things were back then.
Why does this resonate with subsequent generations of people who either were not alive or don't have any direct memory of the events because they were so young, in a way that is greater than other events in our history? There aren't people who are obsessed with the McKinley assassination.
You know,
there might be some. But.
Yeah. If there were pictures of the McKinley assassination, and there's word that there was an actual newsreel of that included part of the shooting. It doesn't survive. It doesn't exist anymore. And it apparently didn't show much, but part of the reason is that there's a mythology about the Kennedys and the Kennedy family that started literally before the assassination. When you have a major publication like Life magazine, which glorified Kennedy and the Kennedy family time and time again, and to have this young leader struck down in such a brutal fashion when he was, 46, he'll never get older. And Jackie remained a national treasure for so many years. So the mythology surrounding this is much bigger. People don't remember that Kennedy was not a very effective president. And now it seems like, he could do all these wonderful things and accomplished everything except get us out of Vietnam. Well, the experts today aren't even sure whether he would have pulled us out of Vietnam.
Gary Mack is curator of the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. Tom Jennings is executive producer of the new documentary, The Lost JFK Tapes, The Assassination, which debuts Monday, November 23rd at 8. Guys, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.